Brian Lehrer, and this is my Daily Politics Podcast from WNYC Studios. It's Tuesday, February 18th.
I don't think you should be able to hide behind airwaves and huge ad buys. He has to come on these shows, and I also am an advocate for him coming on the debate stage.
Senator Amy Klobuchar on CNN on Sunday, and the senator will now get her wish as Michael Bloomberg, who she was referring to there, has officially qualified for tomorrow night's Democratic debate in Nevada by getting over 10% support in another qualifying poll. In fact, in the NPR PBS Marist poll that put him over the top, Bloomberg got 19% among Democrats nationally, second only to Bernie Sanders, who got 31%. And that rising support for Senator Sanders is a story in its own right. We'll talk about that and the bigger picture of the state of our nation now with President Obama's former White House communications director, Dan Pfeiffer, who you may know better these days as co-host of the very popular podcast, Pod Save America. Dan Pfeiffer has a new book called Untrumping America, A Plan to Make America a Democracy Again. Dan, thanks for joining us. Welcome to WNYC.
Thanks for having me.
So to not mince words right from the start here, and for people who don't know the things you tend to say, you see Trumpism as billionaire-funded racial grievance politics. I have many listeners who would say that's been the basis of Republicanism their whole lives. So what has Trump changed in this regard, as you see it, other than just stating it explicitly rather than in euphemisms?
I think that's exactly right. Trump has done to politics much what he did to real estate in New York, which is find a pre-existing structure and put his name on it. And I think this is a thing too many Democrats and a lot of folks just in politics generally are naive about, which is that Trump is not an aberration. He's the logical extension of a Republican Party that goes back decades. And he has said the quiet part out loud. And I believe that when he is gone, we will be dealing with Trumpism long after he walks out of that White House for the last time.
I read with great interest the final pages of your book, which were a rant against former House Speaker and Mitt Romney's 2012 running mate, Paul Ryan, who you accuse of seeing Trump as a way to achieve his cruel policy goals. So in the years leading up to Trump, why did you see Paul Ryan as pursuing cruel policy goals? He had a reputation as kind of a Republican policy intellectual.
For those who listen to Pod Save America, you'll know that I will sometimes end up in a rant about Paul Ryan. And when I was writing the book, I found myself with writer's block. And the only way I could cure the writer's block was to end up writing a very long rant about Paul Ryan. And the reason I have perhaps disproportionately strong feelings about the former speaker is I think he represents so much about what it is in the Republican Party that got us to this moment, which is advocating a very cruel policy that has very quietly, not even quietly, not so subtly, racially divisive, trying to, as Paul Ryan would say, separating the makers and the takers within our economy. And someone who we know from his own words had very low regard for Trump, the kind of president he would be, called him some things he said, textbook example of racism. And then once Donald Trump got in office, he did everything Donald Trump wanted for him. And that's how we got here.
Let me drill down on that example that you just mentioned, because people will remember Ryan called out Trump for what Ryan called a textbook example of racism when Trump, during the 2016 campaign, said a judge could not fairly rule on a case involving Trump just because the judge was Mexican-American. Never mind that the judge was born and grew up in Indiana. Trump called him Mexican, and Ryan called him out. But wouldn't you also say that shrinking government programs for the poor, the centerpiece of Ryan's politics that so upsets you, was the euphemism of his era for the idea that America is filled with undeserving black people and I'm going to protect our money, quote unquote, from being taken from by them?
100%. You can draw a direct line from this idea that what is wrong with America is food stamps and Medicaid and programs that help the poor to Donald Trump's policies this day of today. And that was why I write about this in the book, is that we have to understand where Donald Trump came from. And where he came from is from people like Paul Ryan. Paul Ryan's enabling of Trump is something that happened post-2017. But Paul Ryan helped create Donald Trump long before Donald Trump came on the scene by trying to divide Americans into these categories of, as I said, makers and takers, sort of hardworking white people and everyone else.
And yet something is new here. with Trumpism. And so just to linger on Paul Ryan for one more question, do you think that he generally thought there were two tracks here? One thing is racist, saying the Mexican judge. Another thing is not racist, not looking at, you know, the long lines of American history that led to the disparities and the programs that he wanted to cut?
Yes, I think that there, what Paul Ryan and so many Republicans pre-Trump wanted was to run on a agenda of racial grievance. It dates back to Nixon and the silent majority, the Southern strategy, to sort of weaponize, particularly in the modern era, the racial backlash to Barack Obama's presidency, to do that, yet somehow not cross some proverbial line in their mind that Trump just jumped right over. And there's been zero self-reflection in the Republican Party about their silence during birtherism, the advocacy of these policies, and how that's connected to Donald Trump being president today.
How do you, as someone who worked for President Obama, explain his getting elected and then reelected in the context of the racism that you're right about?
This is something that I spent some portion of every day since 2016 thinking about. And it does seem completely discordant that it's possible that a country that could not just elect Barack Obama, elect him overwhelmingly. He's the only president since Eisenhower to get the majority of the vote twice. And then follow up our first African-American president with someone with a, like Donald Trump, with a long history of embracing white supremacy and white supremacists. And I think the best way to understand that is two things. One, the steps that Republicans took post-Obama's election to make it harder for people of color to vote in this country. Gerrymandering, voter suppression, gutting the Voting Rights Act, and a long history of racial progress being followed by backlash. And I think when you read a lot of the histories of what happened after Reconstruction and after the passage of the Voting Rights Act, that this is in that line. And I think a lot of us, myself included, were naive to the fact that that was a possibility post-Obama.
You write about the media in your book, centrally a section called Facebook plus Fox equals effed, and you use a whole word, Facebook plus Fox equals effed. Explain.
I think it is important to understand that there is a direct relationship between how we got Trump and what is happening in the media in this country. And too often, progressives blame traditional media, like if only the New York Times wrote this different headline, or so-and-so did something else, or why did CNN put Donald Trump on, well, you know, why did we carry the empty podium live during the election? All those things are legitimate criticisms, and I have often been someone who has intemperamentally tweeted about those things. But there is a larger structural impediment to progressive messaging, which is the primary driver of media economics and social conversation in this country is Facebook. And Facebook, for all of the conservative claims about tech bias towards Democrats in Silicon Valley and all the Democrats who run tech companies, Facebook is a pro-conservative platform. And this is not just the policy decisions they've made to allow Trump's campaign to run lies. It is that the algorithm that powers what content people see is one that responds to outrage. And outrage is the coin of the realm in Trump politics, and it benefits Republicans, which is why whenever you see the list of the stories that are getting the most traction on Facebook, they're always from conservative outlets, not progressive outlets.
You don't think there's enough outrage in progressive America these days to balance that out?
It's not in the way Facebook works, right? It is just simply not. It is not how we speak. It is not these political strategies we employ. And it is essentially the weaponization of outreach by folks like Ben Shapiro, Fox News, and a whole plethora of pro-Trump sites that are pushing the conversation in this country to the right.
And part of that analysis that I found really interesting in your book is that you see a dwindling difference between the things the Beltway insiders tend to obsess over and what the general electorate cares about, driven by Fox and Facebook. Can you talk about that?
For much of the first few years Obama was in the White House, his first term, we would always be in this situation where you're in the White House and it feels like you're under constant fire and CNN's doing this segment and Politico's writing the story and you're like, it feels like the whole country is obsessed with whatever the political crisis du jour is. And then you go out and talk to voters, which we would do, you know, through the Obama campaign, and find out they have no idea what we're talking about. They're living very separate lives. They're watching local news. They're reading the local newspaper. They're not mainlining political content.
So you mean Republican-driven scandal narratives like Benghazi or the IRS scandal, things like that,
yeah,
weren't registering at first?
those types of scandals in the first term did not register, you know, whether people thought Obama golfed too much or, you know, some, you know, malfeasance here or something someone tweeted or something like that. That wasn't a problem. In the second term, all of a sudden, you know, and we were shocked to find this, we would go out and talk to regular voters and they would know exactly all of these scandals because Facebook had reached a tipping point and was now pushing these narratives into their feed. The ability to turn politics on and off had gone away. And because conservatives were at the forefront, both in terms of thinking about this and had the benefit of pushing on the open door of Facebook's algorithm, then we were seeing not just that they were learning about these things, they were learning about them from a conservative frame.
How do you see, how do you explain impeachment and Trump-Ukraine in that context, though? Even Democratic primary voters seem to have largely tuned impeachment out as irrelevant to them and almost solely brought up kitchen table issues to the Democratic primary candidates on the stump these recent months, according to every reporter who I've interviewed.
Well, that is definitely true that that's how Democratic primary electorate, particularly in Iowa and New Hampshire, are have been thinking about it. You know, Positive America did a poll of Wisconsin and Arizona right about the time these stories broke. And we found in that poll that 91% of voters, not Democrats, all voters in the states were following that story very closely. But I do think that we went into impeachment with voters knowing that the election was the only way Trump was going to leave. And so when they were engaging with a candidate who there was really a job interview to see how what kind of nominee they would be, whether they had what it took to beat Trump, they were focused on those issues. But people were paying very close attention to impeachment.
And I wonder if the same thing, the tuning out, is happening again now as cable news obsesses over William Barr as the big threat to democracy versus the Fox version, which is Barr trying to restore a political justice after Carter Page's FISA application and Strzok Page and all of that. My question is, do you see and do you think most people really see the future of democracy in which justice officials are going after other Justice Department officials? And it gets framed on television on either side as this is the future of democracy or not in this country versus things more relevant to most people's lives.
Well, I think that it is incumbent upon Democrats, this is one of the reasons why I wrote the book, to lead the charge on democracy reform. We have to explain to voters and make our voters care about, make swing voters care about the fact that Donald Trump did not break our democracy. We have Donald Trump because we have a broken democracy. And to explain to voters that what Democrats want is to ensure that as many people in America have the opportunity to participate in our process. And Republicans are trying to keep people from doing it because they want to keep power in the hands of powerful special interest corporations, Wall Street banks. And that is why we are pushing for making it easier to vote, getting rid of gerrymandering, getting rid of the Electoral College, fixing the Senate. That we have to, if Democrats do not make democratic reform the central piece of our agenda, we will certainly not convince people that it matters, but we also will get nothing done. And that's one of the things I keep taking away from this primary is we've had this very important, very detailed debate about what we're going to do on healthcare in particular. We need to spend all this much time talking about how we're going to get it done, because if we do not, for example, get rid of the filibuster and make the Senate more Democratic, then it doesn't matter if you're for Medicare for all, Medicare for some, Medicare for one more person in this country, it's not going to get done.
Are you supporting anyone in the Democratic presidential race?
I am not. I'm a California resident, so I have another 2 weeks to make up my mind. And based on the way things are going, who knows who's going to be at the top of that that list when I get there.
Let's touch on some of the news from the race. Michael Bloomberg will now be in tomorrow night's Nevada debate. Democrats and MSNBC are criticizing Bloomberg with the tapes that have surfaced of his past remarks on stop and frisk and redlining and his past sexist comments and his campaign spending per se. But he was getting bashed equally on Fox last night as I was flipping around for emerging old tapes on other subjects, including this from 2011 on not spending healthcare dollars on very old people.
And all of these costs keep going up. Nobody wants to pay any more money. And at the rate we're going, healthcare is going to bankrupt us. So not only do we have a problem, it's going to bankrupt us. And we've got to sit here and say which things we're going to do and which things we're not. Nobody wants to do that. You know, if you show up with prostate cancer and you're 95 years old, we should say, go and enjoy, have an ice cream, lead a long life. There's no cure, and you can't do anything. If you're a young person, we should do something about it. Society's not willing to do that yet.
So if that sound quality wasn't good enough for you to hear, folks, he was basically saying, if you're a 95-year-old guy who comes in with prostate cancer, they tell you, go, good luck, have a nice rest of your life. If you're younger, then they spend the money on more aggressive treatment. What do you think about that clip? And in general, can Bloomberg, even with his money, rise as our next president with all this history of offending people in both parties' bases?
Well, there is no history of anyone being elected president with a history of offending people. So,
no, that never happens.
Not once.
Certainly
in American history.
Not in 2016.
That's right. Look, Michael Bloomberg has a lot of questions to answer. He's going to have the opportunity to do so on the debate stage this week. Because up until now, Michael Bloomberg, the person with a record, has not been running. He has been a brand, a $250 million worth of television ads brand. And now, you know, there's going to be some more focus on his record, and he's going to have to defend it. He's going to have to defend it in person to the face of his opponents. And I think Democratic voters are going to look very carefully to see if he really is the quote-unquote electable candidate some of them are looking for.
If Biden and Bloomberg and Buttigieg all have the level of baggage that they do, I'm curious what you think of Amy Klobuchar as the centrist to defeat Sanders in the primary, to the extent that there is a centrist coalition that wants to do that, and the Democrat to defeat Trump, if those two things are one's goals.
Democrats have been really wrapped around the axle of this concept of electability ever since 2016. It's a very ethereal thing. It is cloaked in, is also wrapped around gender and racial tropes that are very, I think, damaging. But ultimately, it's about, for these candidates to explain, what is their strategy for beating Trump? Why are they the best person to do it? And on paper, Amy Klobuchar has, I think, the most obvious example of anyone else. She is the only one in the top category there with a history of winning in a Republican state. Minnesota should be thought of as a swing state. It was incredibly close last time, will probably be closer this time. She has a geographic affinity to Wisconsin, the state we absolutely need to win to get the presidency. So I think she has a very good case. She has a lot of work to do to get to a point where she has the support necessary to compete both organizationally, financially, and among voters to compete when the campaign goes national in 2 weeks.
Joe Biden, you must know him well.
I've been high up
in the Obama administration for 7 years. I was surprised by this exchange on Meet the Press on Sunday with host Chuck Todd.
Have you thought about the fact that the president's campaign against you and your son might have been effective? I mean, that it might have cost you Iowa, might have cost
you
New Hampshire. Has that crossed your mind?
It has, but, I can't focus on that, Chuck. I got to focus on the future.
Do you think Trump Ukraine either hurt or helped Biden, or neither? Most reporters on the trail, when I asked that question, seemed to say neither, but Biden seemed uncertain in that answer.
I think the answer is neither. I think, look, at the absolute peak of the focus on Ukraine, Biden was still well in the lead nationally. We saw no erosion among his favorables among Democratic voters. And so I do not believe that this had an impact one way or the other on his campaign. To the extent there was an opportunity to use it to rally support among Democrats, I don't think they did that either. I think he lost for different reasons. Iowa was always his worst state among the earliest ones. And I don't believe his campaign did a particularly good job of managing their expectations there. They seemed to be the only people surprised to come in where they did. But I don't think to the extent he's having challenges, it has more to do with his campaign in the state of the Democratic electorate than anything that Trump did.
Given Hunter Biden's questionable decision to take the Burisma job, which everybody says is questionable, why didn't the administration not use the vice president as the point person on Ukraine so as not to risk an appearance of a conflict of interest?
Well, I don't remember, even if I was in the White House when all this was happening. Ukraine was not in my
portfolio. It was like 2013,
yeah,
so you were there.
I was there, and Ukraine certainly not in my portfolio. I do think it's important that people take a step back and recognize that there was nothing controversial about what the vice president was advocating for. We weren't asking him to do anything that was anyone disagreed with. It was the position of the Democrats, position of the Republicans, position of the IMF, all of our allies, the international community, people in Ukraine, that prosecutor be fired. And so this wasn't like it's it has been weaponized in a way that is very distorting and dangerous. But in the moment, he was basically doing the thing that every single person thought was the right thing to do and was against the interest of his son's company. And so in
because
every
they
way
were firing the corrupt prosecutor.
Yes, exactly, who was potentially protecting them. So it was the most likely scenario was if this prosecutor was fired, which Biden was delivering a message that everyone in the world agreed with, it would put more Burisma in more legal jeopardy, not less.
He was, or other White House officials were, asked by the press at the time, isn't this a conflict of interest when Hunter Biden joined that board? And yet you're saying people in the White House just didn't consider a problem.
And I know that there has been reporting since then that showed that some people within the State Department and others raised the issue. I don't remember it at the time being considered a problem, but my memory is eroding by the moment, and it's these things are all among the one gazillion issues you deal with on any day in the White House. This was nowhere near the top of the list, in on my portfolio at least.
Deborah in Morris County, you're on WNYC with Dan Pfeiffer. Hi, Deborah.
Hi. It's a pleasure to listen to your show all the time.
Thank you.
And Mr. Pfeiffer, I'm honored to be able to speak to you.
Thank you.
Have a question about culpability. A lot of the losses all around the country, Democratic losses in states, happened in 2010 before the census, and then in 2012, significantly after the census. But I am wondering if the entire White House recognized its culpability and not realizing that the head of the Senate saying, we want to make you a one-term president, was part and parcel of a larger Republican goal to take over the country in state house after state house after state house.
And Deborah, I'm going to leave it there for time, but you knew Mitch McConnell had as his main goal not to pass great compromise policy measures with the new Democratic president who said there's no red America, no blue America. It was stated to make Obama a one-term president. Could the president, could you, could the administration have done anything different to avoid that backlash that flipped the Congress and all those state houses?
Oh, I'm like, without a doubt, we could do more and better. I think I write an entire chapter in the book on this where I try to look at what led to that loss in 2010. And there are a number of factors there where we could have been more attentive to some of these down ballot races, you know, more focused on some other elements. But there are bigger structural things here, which was unemployment was near 10%. And what people forget is that the Citizens United ruling happened in the beginning of 2010, which ended up giving the Republicans a massive spending advantage that hampered us. And so Democrats could have done better on a whole number of things, myself and the Obama administration included. But there were a number of structural factors that made that one very, very challenging, and we suffered mightily for it. And if there was anything we could have done more, I wish we had done it, because that election has rung forward in history for a decade now.
Last thing then, you're right that you surprise people when they ask if you have a biggest regret about missions not accomplished by the Obama administration, and you say something people rarely think about called the Employee Free Choice Act. Want to explain?
Right. As I write in the book, many people will say, who I worked with will say, immigration reform or climate change, all of which are incredibly important. I when I think back to the politics of that time, I'm not sure given a Senate majority that included Joe Manchin and Joe Lieberman and senators from Arkansas that those things were necessarily possible. But I do think one thing that we should have done was pass more laws to strengthen labor unions. Because what would happen soon after 2010 is Scott Walker, the Koch brothers, would begin passing these right to work and anti-collective bargaining agreements. And I tell this story in the book for two reasons. One, I think it's critically important to deal that Democrats have to do more to support unions and build up unions, but also because I think one of the lessons of the last 10 years of American politics is Democrats are too reticent to do the things that strengthen our political power. The Republicans would never pass up an opportunity to pass a law that they thought was the right thing to do and would help an important political constituency. And so by not stepping up to the plate, which is a failure that is not just Obama's, it's the entire Democrats in Congress, in passing a law that would strengthen unions and protect them from the Koch brothers and others, we missed an important substantive and political opportunity.
Dan Pfeiffer's new book is Untrumping America. His podcast is Pod Save America. And thank you so much for joining us.
Brian, thank you.
And listeners, we want to invite you in on the conversation, too. If you've got a question about a national news item, whether it's something you want to know about the election or the Trump administration or anything else you think might fall under the national politics umbrella, give us a call and leave us a message with your name, where you're calling from, and your question. We'll collect those and keep them in our pocket for when I'm speaking with someone who can give you a good answer. The number is 844-745-TALK. That's 844-745-8255, 844-745-TALK. See you tomorrow.